All right, Disability Law Show. We are back at it. Good to have you along for the ride. John Scholes hosting. I don't do any of the hard work. I get the easy job. Tamara Gopian is here to answer all the questions and do the tough stuff. By the way, you can reach out to Tamara and her team anytime if you have concerns for yourself, possibly a family member who's going through some stuff and not ready to pick up a phone or talk to anybody because they're dealing with a disability or dealing with that insurance company who's about to or has cut them off, asked them to appeal. It can just be one massive headache after another. Do yourself a favor and get some answers. Call Tamara and her team anytime. 1-855-821-5900. Won't cost you a penny just to pick up a phone and ask a couple questions. help@disabilityrights.ca is the email address as well. Okay, they're coming in already fast and furious, tomorrow, the emails for the show today. But we always start off with a case today or a week that was. What's happening on your end, pal? What do you got?
Been really, really busy working on an upcoming mediation. And so I wanted to feature this gentleman's situation because it, John, touches on all of the things that we normally talk about on our shows, short-term disability, long-term disability, employment, all of the good stuff. And so I thought it was a good start off, lead off for our topics today. And so, look, I mean, he was in his 50s, he was doing a fairly physical job, and he had a fairly physical disability. We see this profile a lot. It's he has Crohn's disease, not a pleasant condition by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
There is no cure, okay, that's the key. And it doesn't get better with time. So we call these progressive disabilities, John. And so people will get diagnosed with these kinds of conditions. You know, MS comes to mind, you know, lupus comes to mind. There's so many that I could name that have very similar profiles. Very subjective, right? We're starting off right away talking about these subjective claims where the doctor has to take account of what the patient is reporting in terms of those symptoms, the limitations, and they start off by trying to investigate blood work, other things, and those investigations eventually lead to a diagnosis like this. And that was absolutely the same pattern that my client went through. And so in those years, actually, until he was diagnosed and then properly treated, there was lots of periods where he took short-term disability. And it was short-term for him because it was a period of less than 6 months. And usually that's what we see, is that short-term disability benefits are about four to six months. But the test is the same. So our listeners, the test to qualify is the same, is this idea of total disability. But total disability, I mean, what does that look like? The courts have recognized that that can be different from patient to patient, claimant to claimant. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're laid up in bed all of the time, although there were periods of time for my client where that was the case. And so to his credit, he continued to go back to work and he continued to try and do some shift work and change medications and try and manage this really difficult condition. And it just gets more tiring and more exhausting and a lot more pain. The pain was the biggest thing that he was struggling with. And so in the year leading up to his full disability leave, he had two or three short-term claims and no issues with the short-term claims, John. So those got reviewed by the insurance company and then paid by his employer, which is sometimes what we see with these disability claims, where you have an insurance company looking at the medical information. So not your employer, the insurance company, and then they will make that decision of whether you are approved for these kinds of benefits. No problems. Okay. So where do the problems begin? Well, he has these terms in his policy, which he, of course, he didn't know, and nor did we actually until we got the full file, that said you could only have 26 weeks of short term, so 6 months, in any given year of disability. And then after that, you have to do long-term disability benefits. So fine, he applies for the long-term and wouldn't you know it, gets denied actually for short-term disability benefits. And it was denied, John, like within weeks of him actually having to transition from short-term to long-term. Right. And same test, right? Let's remember, listeners, this is the same exact test. So same insurance company saying, yeah, we have approved these 2, 3, 4, 5 short-term disability claims for you, but we're not approving you for long-term. We think you are well enough to actually go back to work like you did the last 4 times that we approved your short-term claims. Because if he had transitioned to long-term, it would have been the insurance company's money. Right. And that's really what it comes down to. It was the insurance company acting as the gatekeeper of their own funds and not wanting to allow him to transition to long-term, which he absolutely should have done, because then it would have cost the insurance company money. And it was no longer the employer paying the benefit, it would have been the insurance company. So they deny his claim. He actually did try to appeal. And after that appeal wasn't successful and they were sort of pointing him in 30 different directions, oh, go back to work, oh, do accommodation, no, you should, you know, submit this other form, a lot of runaround, John. And he was just completely done. And his doctors were saying, look, this isn't helping your circumstances. Stress actually makes your disease worse. You really need to take a complete break from work and let's see where you're at. And in fact, things have not improved, unfortunately, for him. He still has pain. It's considered chronic. It's considered permanent. And he's on these, you know, long wait lists to try and see a pain management clinic and see if there's anything more they can do for him. And so in that time, we've started the legal claim and we are pursuing the insurance company. This is a long intro, John, because there is also an employment component to this.
Right.
So insurance company denies, right? Then employer looks at this and says, oh, well, we don't think you're actually coming back. We actually don't think you're well enough to return. So we're going to terminate your employment on the basis of what's called frustration of contract. No joke. I mean, this is all of the elements of claims that we talk about. Most claims just have one or two of these issues. And so this is why I wanted to highlight his situation, because it lines up so well with the type of work that I do, the type of work that many of the members of our team does, these components of employment and disability. And what do you do in a situation like that? He is literally stuck between his employer saying, well, they've obviously terminated him now, but his employer saying, we don't think you're well enough to work. And the insurance company saying, we think you're well enough to work, so you should go back to work. It's unbelievable. And so the answer is to give us a call and let us help you. None of this makes any sense. And I don't expect our listeners to even understand half of what I've just described in a situation sure. like this. It's intentional, John. They do it on purpose. They don't want to tell you that there's these limits in your policy. They don't actually want to explain to you that, you know, you could qualify for short-term and long-term and it's the same test. They will prefer to deny the claim, hope that that either forces you back to work or you figure it out. You leave the money on the table and you never pursue your legal rights. But in the context of a legal claim, they don't get that pass. The insurance company's lawyers will have to look at it. The employer's lawyers will have to look at it. And they will look at it, I can assure you, in the way that I'm looking at it, which is this doesn't make sense. Not only does the insurance company need to approve and pay the long-term disability benefit, but the employer is on the hook for not only paying more of the short-term and potentially a whack for termination pay, severance pay, and all of the things that go with improperly terminating someone. And that's really where we're at. So we're at the doorsteps of this mediation, John, and I'm looking at all of this, and I thought, I'm going to highlight and feature this gentleman's situation because, you know, what I fear, John, is that people don't actually take that additional step and give us a call and actually allow us to assert those legal rights. And, you know, I think we get lots of phone calls, certainly, and we have the opportunity to help lots of people, and it's very rewarding work, and we enjoy it. Frankly, I think we're pretty darn good at it. But that initial step has to be taken from our listeners, friends and family. If people are out there and thinking, gosh, that sounds like Bob. Oh, that sounds like Judy. You know what? I'm going to get them to call Sam Firu to Mark, and I really hope that people do so that we have this opportunity to advocate. Because without it, I can assure you that the insurance company and the employer in this situation would have just sat back and thought, yeah, you know what? We did absolutely the right thing, which was absolutely against the law in both circumstances.
It's interesting, too, because, you know, Bob and Judy in the end, they're like sometimes think, oh, this is going to be too complicated. I don't want any lawyers. I don't want to be in court. And they just shrug it all off. And this ends up costing them both from a physical standpoint and what could arguably be the bigger, more important issue from a monetary standpoint, because they're missing out on benefits and things they should have. Right. So it's worth just a phone call and don't be scared of it.
Absolutely. We try and make it really simple to work with us and speak with us. Our consultations are absolutely free. We can spend an hour, half an hour, 45, however long people need to talk to us. We speak to family members actually as well, so that everyone's in the loop in getting the advice that they need from us. And then if it makes sense to retain us, and John, it often does, then we will suggest to you, okay, look, this is what the retainer looks like. You know, you don't pay us anything. We work exclusively on contingency. you know, we don't get paid unless you get paid, that sort of thing. And it's very, very simple. And the simplicity really follows from that initial step. And so I don't want people to feel like these claims end up in court. In fact, very few claims in any realm of civil litigation ever end up in court. And so these insurance companies and frankly, these employers are very risk adverse. That means that they want to resolve these claims because most often, if it does get before a judge or a court, that's first of all, many, many years down the road. They don't want to wait that long because the benefit continues to be payable. And they get their wrist slapped, John, when they've made the wrong decisions and they've maintained that decision for many, many years. That's the real problem with insurers. And so they are just as motivated as our clients are to try and have a sit down, have a reasonable discussion about resolving these claims and come to the table in the way that makes sense that frankly they should have done from the start. But they don't because many people don't assert those rights. This is what I'm getting at is that the percentage of people who don't actually take that step is so high. Much prefer to see people advocating and asserting those rights and allowing us to take that stress away because it does go away. The calls go away, emails, letters, all of those things happening from either the employer or the insurance company then becomes my problem. They have to deal with me, whether they like it or not. And, and in that way, my clients and their families can focus exclusively on their health and their well-being.
And with that amazing opening, we'll get into a short break here. Got lots more coming up around the corner, so stick with us. In the meantime, you can always send your email questions along to Tamar and her team. They might appear on a future show. That's help@disabilityrights.ca, or just leapfrog that and make the phone call right to Tamar and her team as well. 1-855-821-5900. More Disability Law Show is coming up. Stay tuned. All right, back with the Disability Law Show. Good to have you along for the ride. Tamar Agopian's here. Samfiru Tamarkin, LLP. Tamar is who you want to reach out to anytime. She has, she's been on the dark side with the insurance companies before. She's worked there, so she knows the inner workings. She has pulled back the curtain of Oz, and she knows exactly what goes on behind those doors. So you're in really good hands when you talk to Tamar if you've got some issue with a disability insurer. Reach out by phone when the show's done. No problem. 1-855-821-5900. help@disabilityrights.ca is the email address, and it's the one that Carrie used, of course, Tamar, as we get into our content for the remainder of the hour. Carrie says, Tamar, I've been on LTD for over 5 years. I just read a section of my policy, which is about cost of living and the method for calculating changes to the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. I have the relevant pages of the policy, but it's not clear to me whether this means the insurer should have been adjusting my benefits by adding cost of living all along. I'm worried I haven't been paid properly. Kind of a math thing, Tamar, but I mean, it's still, you get this question all the time. What's your opinion on it?
We do. We do get this question a lot. Math is my least favorite subject. And here, yet, here. John, we do it every day. And so look, this is a very important question these days because of rising inflation, right? Interest rates are high, all the things that are happening in our world. And so what is difficult for people to understand is, you know, shouldn't I also be getting that adjustment every year on my LTD benefit? Let's take this a step back. The way that LTD, short-term, long-term, the way that these benefits get calculated are on typically your base salary, your base earnings. That's even including people who have commissions and sales. Sometimes that's factored into, but more often than not, the way that it gets negotiated in at least in a group disability plan is that your employer will report your earnings level to the insurance company. Insurance company will rate that premium. It goes back to your employer, and then there's a set amount based on what they've negotiated that you will be covered for. Now, short-term disability usually is anywhere between 75% to 100% of what you're making. And as I said at the top of the show, it's usually for 4 to 6 months or anywhere between 17 and 26 weeks. With long-term disability, typically the percentage is even less, John. So it's either 2/3 of what you're making. So again, 66.67% of your earnings, or it can be some calculation where it's half of your earnings for the first $2,500 and then the other half of the balance. And again, you can get really into the weeds on these numbers. And so the point being is that number one, Carrie will want to know, what is her coverage? What option did she have if she has a group plan that she set with her employer when she set up her benefits? And that will dictate to her whether she actually has any adjustments that apply to that monthly disability benefit. Because it then gets set, if she's been off for 5 years, then she's been on the same LTD benefit for those 5 years.
That's right.
But if your policy provides for a cost of living adjustment, then she's correct. She should have been receiving it either once a year after her disability benefits began, or come every January when we would normally see any sort of adjustment. And so if I'm her, yes, I want to see the policy. Send it to me, Carrie. I'll take a look. But more importantly, you want to check your benefits coverage summary with your employer to see whether or not you had that option or that additional coverage for what we call COLA.
Yep.
And if that's the case, then you've got to alert the insurance company right away. The challenge with the improper calculation with disability benefits, John, is that when you've been on claim for a while, there's an idea, this concept of acquiescence. It means that you've agreed that the insurance company has properly put in this information for you and you've accepted that benefit month over month. Now look, if you discover that it's incorrect and you raise it with the insurance company, then I personally feel that that resets the clock in terms of making that argument. But we know that in all the jurisdictions that we practice in, including Ontario, BC, Alberta, all over, it's a 2-year window. So let's say in a world, Carrie figured this out tomorrow, but waited more than 2 years to actually raise an issue with the insurance company. Well, a court might turn around and say, look, sorry, Carrie, you're out of time. Not only did you accept these benefits for a number of years, but you didn't even do anything about it once you realized that there was an error.
Right.
So you want to act quickly and you want to make sure that you get a response from the insurance company in writing about how they've calculated the benefit and what section they reviewed and perhaps even some clarity around your coverage. Because if it's not clear, then my spidey senses always go up and I think, well, why is it not clear? Between the insurance company and the employer, it should be crystal clear what you're entitled to, and there should be documentation that supports that analysis. I think where it gets a little confusing, John, and it could be this is Carrie's situation, I don't know, is that people will get a benefits booklet from their employer, and the booklet doesn't necessarily have all of the terms and conditions yeah. for their disability benefit. So oddly enough, I mean, you look at these books, I see them and I see the booklet and I think, you know, this isn't giving people enough information. You actually need the full policy, the one that exists between the employer and the insurance company. And you want to see in there if you're a different category of employee and where perhaps this language exists about the CPI or the cost of living adjustment, because it could be potentially 2-4% a year on top of what she's been getting the last 5 years. And that could be a very significant number because it compounds. So again, don't want to get into all of the math, John, but
sure.
You can imagine a world where, you know, you add 3%, then you're adding 3% to the 3% that was added to the prior percent. So
right. For
those who know what compounding interest is, I think you'll understand. But at the end of the day, the conclusion is that you don't want to be leaving money on the table with the insurer. You want to make sure you understand very clearly what you're covered for and that you have the right policy reviewed so that if there is a mistake being made by the insurer, you can actually address it with them, get an official response. And if they don't want to do something about it or if it's not being properly addressed, then please pick up the phone. There are options and we can assert those legal rights for the difference against the insurer for the cost of living adjustment.
Well, as you mentioned, that COLA can be substantial and it's worth pursuing. And obviously, we're not going to turn this into an insurance show because you're not a broker. But in your experience thus far, a private policy versus a group policy through your employer, does a group policy usually, have you seen a COLA added into that? Or is that something you don't usually get that benefit if you're part of a work policy? You get the bare minimum. But, you know, a private policy, yeah. Maybe it would have that in there. Is that what you found?
Yeah, that's a really good point, John, is that most of the time when we're talking about these policies on our shows, we are generally talking about group disability mm-hmm. policies. So yep. They're ones that we see where employers offer them for their employees.
Yes.
And, you know, COLA is expensive. That's an add-on.
Right.
And most employers will not offer that as an option. They'll offer a core or basic LTD benefit. They may say at the employee's expense, you can get a better option or a higher option where a cost of living adjustment might be included in that. But again, most people, when they're starting out a new job, John, they're not even looking at these options. You should, and you're right, I'm not a broker, but you should if you do have that chance to take a look and add that coverage on. I recommend it. The COLA can be a big difference. But when you're looking at, you know, group versus individual, that is a totally different dynamic, right? Because you've got the same insurers offering very different insurance products. And so they may be offering something to employers who have a big employee base at a really great premium, you know, relatively low, this kind of thing to cover a bunch of people. And that may not look the same if you try and go out and find your own insurance as an individual person. But the good side to doing that individual policy is that it's not attached to your employer. So if you change employers, you can carry it out over that individual plan to wherever it is that you may be from an employment perspective, and you get to choose what bits that you want in your disability policy. And so do you want a cost of living adjustment? Is it worth for you to pay that, you know, as part of your overall premium for an individual policy? Do you want it to look like an annuity? Do you want to, again, I'm giving more broker advice than it's worth, but I think the bottom line is that in my experience, you want to have at least some kind of coverage. So especially if you're self-employed, for example, and this sort of thing, you want to have that coverage so that in the event that worst case scenario, if you are in a situation where you cannot work, you can hopefully rely on these kinds of policies, and you want the policy to be as responsive to your needs as it is worth to you to pay, right? And that's the cost-benefit analysis that each individual has to do, whether they're doing a group disability plan or they're doing an individual one.
Which is why I asked. I knew I would get an awesome answer from you. So there you go. There's another website, by the way, we use every show, and you can use it. It's free and anonymous. It's similar to email. You just type in, ask your questions, but it's a little different than the fact that you can search the database to see if your question has been asked before. That's the way it was designed. It's called mydisabilityquestions.com, all one word, mydisabilityquestions.com. And we'll pull one from that now. Tamar, let me go through. Says, guys, my question is whether they are obligated to provide a severance or when I'm ready to return to work. LTD is provided up to 65 years of age with my company, and I hope things don't last that long, but who knows? It's been 3 years already. So what do you think about that, Tamar?
It's a great question, and it is a great website for our listeners. If you're feeling a little sheepish about calling the firm, that's totally okay. MyDisabilityQuestions.com is fantastic, and we've got lots of other tools as well. I'm sure John will talk to us about the Pocket Disability Lawyer as well, but let's deal with this individual's question first, which is, look, am I owed a severance? Am I owed a severance if I'm off? I've been off now for 3 years. It could be that I'm on LTD till I'm 65 years old. And he or she is absolutely right that, you know, these disability policies potentially pay you until then. And you just don't know how your health is going to go. I think what's interesting here is that this individual's been off past that magic 2 year mark, right, John? This is where my brain went right away when I looked at this question. And why do I say magic 2 year mark? So for our listeners who haven't heard us talking about what's called the change of definition, this is a good time to listen up. The disability policies generally will have one test to qualify for the first 2 years and another test to qualify after that, from the past the 2 year mark all the way until age 65 potentially. And no surprise, the second part, that 2 years plus till age 65, is actually the tougher test to meet, arguably, between the two. The first part usually is, can you go back to your own job, your own occupation? Can you go back and work fully, earning basically what you were earning while you were working? And, you know, I'm not saying it's easy to get approved in that time frame. It's not. We defend lots of claims where disability insurers have denied or forced people back to work. Mm-hmm. But we see far more denials in the second phase. And so that time frame where the insurance company is looking and analyzing to see, are we going to approve this individual past that initial 2 years? In that time frame where, you know, is this individual totally disabled from any occupation, any setting, in any capacity that would roughly pay them 2/3? That's really where we see a lot of insurers getting very hot and bothered, and they aggressively will deny disability claims. And so when I read into emails and text messages and other things that we get and phone calls that they've gotten past that 2 years, then that suggests to me that perhaps there is some permanency, that it is a prolonged disability, that perhaps it isn't going to resolve tomorrow or the next day or the day after. And so if you are going to remain on a disability leave and you are approved by the disability insurer, I think, frankly, the chances are pretty high your employer is not going to want to do a whole heck of a lot with your employment. Yeah. The concern they'll probably have is, look, if we terminate and we don't actually go through the process of accommodation and doing all the other things that an employer is meant to do, that may expose them to human rights claims.
That's right.
Undoubtedly so, right? And so on the other side of that, though, is just because you want a severance doesn't mean you're entitled to one. And so the challenge becomes, you know, are you owed one? Not necessarily, but could there be a basis to terminate your employment on the basis of potentially frustration of contract? Yes, that could potentially happen. But you know what, John? Let's pick up that concept because we didn't really get into it much at the top of the show either. I want to explain to our listeners what that means, touch on a little bit of that employment side, and then maybe we can hit up another email or two for our show.
You bet. We sure will. We'll take that short break and get into more. And in the meantime, you can always send yours along. It may appear in a future show. How about that? Email help@disabilityrights.ca. And the question we're answering comes from mydisabilityquestions.com. All available to you, of course, free and anonymously. The phone number, too, to call tomorrow and her team, 1-855-821-5900. More Disability Law Show is coming right up. Hang in there. That's right. We're back. Disability Law Show rolls on. Some time to go. So in between this show and the next one, you can always send along your emails and questions to Tamar and her team. They'll get answered. They get answered regardless, but they may appear in this show, which is kind of cool. Email address we always use is help@disabilityrights.ca. And there's also the option of mydisabilityquestions.com. Free and anonymous, searchable. That's the way the algorithm works. So you can see if your question is already logged in and answered previously by someone else wondering the same thing, right? That or the phone number, 1-855-821-5900. Okay, Tamar, let's pick up where we left off with our last question. 65 years of age, company let go, severance. Is there going to be severance? They're just wondering how that whole thing's played out, right?
Right. And so what I wanted to touch on was, you know, this idea of, you know, could you get a severance? Is there going to be a severance? So the easy answer to that is not necessarily, right? So if you're on an approved disability leave, it may not mean that you're going to, you know, trigger the end of your employment. But there is one means in which employers have done this or that we've done on behalf of our employees. So I want to touch on this concept called frustration of contract. It's a legal principle. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. It has to be initiated. So either the employer or the employee has to say this exists. And it exists if there's medical support that the disability is preventing the individual from returning for what's called the foreseeable future. Now, look, these are lots of legal terms, John, so I want to really, really simplify it. If the conclusion is between yourself as a patient and your doctor that there is a very low likelihood or an unlikelihood that you're ever going to return to the job that you had before you became sick, then the writing is probably on the wall that frustration of contract exists, at least medically, potentially. Now, I never want to suggest to people that this is where they should go. You should absolutely be getting legal advice before you go down this path at all, either with your employer, or if your employer decides to trigger it, come to us. Don't accept that that's simply the reality, because it may not be. And some employers do this a little bit too aggressively, John. And what's even more confusing, unfortunately, for people who come out to talk to us and try and get advice is that the law is not clear on when this frustration of contract exists. In other words, if I'm off for a year, is that frustration? If I'm off for 2 years, is that frustration? Generally, it would be 2 years or more when you're off work for a health reason that then could establish this kind of a legal principle. But at the end of the day, I think there needs to be just some general awareness that just because you're off on a disability leave doesn't mean you should get fired or will get fired. And the opposite is also true. Just because you're on a leave due to your health reasons doesn't necessarily mean that your job's going to remain forever in time. Okay. And so it's a delicate balance, but again, goes back to what I said at the top of the show, which is we are well suited to deal with this. If you are not sure, how do I deal with my employment? How do I deal with my disability? Who should I call? This is why we have lawyers like myself who deal with both areas for the overlap that exists time and again. And we can then guide people on how to deal with all of this when they're off, if they're on the cusp of returning, what to do with their employer. All of those circumstances are right in our wheelhouse. And so I gave maybe more than I needed to with this particular question, but it touched on such important subjects that I wanted to put it out there as to what frustration of contract might be and how that might look like for most people.
Good stuff, my friend. As always, it's time to let's go back to another email. Logan writes in, says, I'm 55 years old, used to work as an operations manager for 15 years. I've been off work for almost 3 years on LTD because of long COVID. I've been meeting all the insurance company's requests and requirements for paperwork, and my doctor has done regular blood work and put me through a COVID clinic program to give me the tools to cope with all my symptoms. I still struggle with exhaustion, brain fog, aches, pains, headaches. Even with all this, my case manager just asked me to meet with one of their doctors for an independent assessment. I'm okay to do this, but my overall health is obviously not good, and I'm worried about being forced back to any type of job and then getting fired for not being able to perform. Wow, what do you think about all that, Tamar?
Well, look, long COVID is still a thing, for a lack of better terms, John. I mean, we are still seeing these kinds of claimants. We're still seeing these kinds of patients, and treatment is still difficult to access in the kinds of symptoms that Logan describes. And so it doesn't surprise me in the least that the insurance company has said, hey, you know what? We want to have you assessed by one of our doctors. Mm-hmm. And it's not independent, by the way, Logan. It couldn't be further from the truth, okay? This is the insurance company hiring a doctor, an expert, whatever, quote-unquote expert, someone that they're paying for, who they will direct to answer 4 or 5 very specific questions about you, Logan, and your health and your health status. And the key question that they want medical evidence on is, can you work? And can you work at any occupation? Probably, since you've been off work for almost 3 years, I suspect that's the zone that you're in your policy. Maybe, maybe not, but most likely. And you are going to attend this assessment, and you're going to have the doctor speak to you, maybe someone on their team, for a little bit. They'll get some background information. They might get parts of your medical file, but don't assume that they do. So I always give the advice, John, that people want to be prepared for these assessments. They want to tell their doctor that this assessment is happening. They want to understand what the assessment's going to involve. So is this a physical assessment, Logan? Or are they, you know, checking up on your mental health? Like, what kind of assessment is this? Is it going to happen over a day or two, or is it an hour? You want to have some clarity around all of that. Who is the doctor, by the way? Who are you seeing? And you want to make sure that your own practitioners are engaged in this process. So you want your own doctor, your own psychologist, your own physiotherapist to know, hey, by the way, I'm going to this 2-day physical assessment. I need you guys, you know, available, and I'm going to take notes, and I'm going to record what happened, what was asked, and all those sorts of things. Very important, because at the end of it, I can assure you there's going to be a report that probably says that Logan can work. And he's absolutely right to be afraid of this idea of being pushed into some other job that he can't perform, that he's not capable of doing, and that's preventing, you know, that his health is preventing for him to return. But these insurers are typically going to invest time and energy and money into these assessments because they want to bring these claims to a close. And long COVID is a tricky one for insurance companies because they don't want to be the first ones out there in front of a judge saying, yeah, we denied an otherwise valid disability claim. They also don't want to be in a situation to have people with long COVID on for longer, frankly, than they need to, because typically with these symptoms, they're very subjective, and insurance companies don't like these subjective claims, right? At the end of the day, it can't go from A to B, close out, right? It's not neat and tidy like a broken arm would be. And this is why we're seeing these kinds of strategies being put in place for long COVID claimants. Same types of things they were doing in the past, John, but I think a little bit more vigorously in terms of let's get them assessed, even though there's really no expert on long COVID. And let's see if we can find a basis to deny the claim, because otherwise the concern is that we've got this guy on forever and a day. So look, Logan, we've got a really helpful memo on these medical assessments on another website of ours called LTDFAQ.ca. Mm-hmm. Take a look at that. There's some good tips there. And if you've got any other questions, you know where to reach us. Right, John?
Logan, you bet. Logan, appreciate the note and reaching out for sure. That's how it's done. So you can also send your emails along anytime. We'll appear on a future show. We'll take one more quick break. Get back to more emails and questions. help@disabilityrights.ca is where we're going. That and the phone number beyond the show, 1-855-821-5900. This is the Disability Law Show. All right, we're back. A few minutes to go here this week on the Disability Law Show. You want to reach out to Tamar anytime, and her team at the firm, always ready just to have a No obligation chat. Just ask some questions. Get your bearings. Get a bit of basic information. It's there for you to take. It's 1-855-821-5900 by phone, email as well. help@disabilityrights.ca. Tomorrow, that's where we're going. AC is up next. Says, I am currently on LTD following a heart attack, and I have a question about my participant's life insurance policy. It is my understanding that this type of policy has an amount the insured can access while living. Can you please confirm? It also appears this type of policy should pay dividends to the policy holder. Is that correct? It is a group policy, but I have been told and have in writing a value pertaining to me as an individual. Any clarification you can provide would be greatly appreciated. No kid, even I'm confused by this one. What is going on there tomorrow?
John, it's very confusing because remember what I was saying earlier about this idea of different insurers offering different products. And so what we're seeing, there's one, I think this is the insurer I'm thinking of, who offers, so a couple of key things. AC is saying to us that he's got a group aspect of it, and there's this life participant aspect that may pay dividends and this sort of thing. So there's one insurer that's doing this and selling these kinds of products where there's two components to the plan, and there's an individual plan and a group plan, but they're both actually tied to employment, which is super odd, very, very strange, but that's fine. I think really what it comes down to is the terms and conditions. And so, you know, he's absolutely right that you want things in writing, you want to get a better understanding, you want to see what the policy says. And so I think with AC, I'm going to have to see the policy. But if I can guesstimate what it kind of looks like, there are these types of plans, John, where they act kind of like a critical illness plan. So again, another type of insurance product, another product that would relate to having a disability, but really it pertains to specific illnesses. And sometimes heart attacks is, you know, a condition that comes within this list of conditions where you can get a payment or a payout if you've got that health condition. Now, I've also seen denials of these kinds of claims though, right, John? And so, you know, if it's a life insurance policy that pays an amount while you're still living, then you want to understand, are you getting that payout and then you don't have coverage anymore? Or are you getting that payout periodically? Or is it some amount that's triggered and then you still have that coverage? That's one of the things that individuals like AC, I don't expect, will understand. And so when I'm looking at these disability plans, especially individual disability plans, I'm always providing that advice to claimants where I say, look, first of all, I have to see the policy. I'm going to comb through it. If it's something I haven't seen before, by the way, we've got a great team. I'm going to talk to the rest of the team, send it over, say, hey, have you guys seen something like this? And we'll problem solve. But leaving that process aside, the main thing to understand is if it's something that should be paid that you haven't gotten paid, and you have that denial in writing saying, we don't think you qualify, or this doesn't fit within our plan, or we don't think you're sick enough, or the heart attack doesn't qualify, this kind of thing, that's actually what triggers us getting involved. And so we have consults at any phase, at any time. We'll talk to people at any point, John. But if people are saying, look, when do I hire a lawyer? Do I have to fight someone on this? At what point does that occur? It occurs when the insurance company says no to you about something that you think you are entitled to. And that's a really critical concept. Whether you're dealing with a life plan, a critical illness plan, or a disability plan, mortgage protection, like, I mean, I could go on, the list is fairly long, but in any of those instances where the insurer says either you're not covered or you don't qualify is really where you want to get some solid legal advice from disability lawyers who've seen a lot of these products, who can look at it and read it and explain to you, this is what it's meant to do. And this is what is going to be the outcome when we sue or start a legal claim. Because usually you are going to get a buyout of the plan for a period of time. You're going to get a payment. And that payment, at least when it relates to policies like critical illness, is a one time and done. So it's important for people to understand that what is required if you're going down the route of actually initiating a legal claim, getting us involved. And we'll explain all of that to anyone who's contacting us and make those decisions with our potential clients, and then eventually, if we are retained, to move forward. But I think that in this context, and of course, we've had lots of good questions, you know, broker related questions, but in that context, from a disability lawyer perspective, I think it's important for people to get how these kinds of insurance products might work and the mechanisms around that as we embark on potentially challenging the disability insurer.
I think we got time for one more question here from mydisabilityquestions.com tomorrow in the last couple minutes, so let's get that happening. I'm on approved six-week STD claim for mental health and currently being followed by a physician and MSW for counseling. I took a two-week trip to Europe while on STD. My company has suspended my claim and pay unless I provide proof that I was in Canada and proof I followed up with my physician and counselor. Though I booked both for this coming week as I was away, does the company have grounds to suspend my pay? That's not nice.
No, it's not nice. And so, you know, this again goes back to what does the short-term disability policy say about whether or not you can leave the country and still be entitled to the disability benefit? Often there are restrictions around this. And so you want to clearly understand, you know, if you are outside of Canada, does that in and of itself disentitle you for disability benefits? There's exclusions certainly in long-term plans, John. I can't think of one where I've seen that the short-term plan says something around that. So I think that perhaps this has more to do with maybe the insurance company feeling like this individual wasn't being honest or wasn't forthright about their travel plans. Hard to say. But if that's the case, and whether fair or not, my advice would be, hey, like, get a medical report or a letter over to your insurer and make sure that it explains that this was medically supported travel, right? It makes sense that if you're off on a mental health leave, that a doctor or therapist, I think this individual said they're under the care of a physician and a social worker, it would make sense that either one of those practitioners would advise that, yeah, you know what, 2 weeks away could probably do you a lot of good. And we'll touch base sort of halfway through your trip, maybe we'll do another session, all of that. And that can all be documented and provided to the insurer, at least, to explain to them that, look, I wasn't without treatment in any period of time, and nothing was offside here. This was all, you know, approved by my doctors to take that time away. And so I think that's where I would start. And then, of course, have an opportunity for someone like myself to review the plan, the policy wording, to see if there's any exclusions in there about the travel aspect. I got to wonder, though, John, if this has more to do with the treatment part. And so, you know, perhaps the policy doesn't have a restriction for this individual to be out of the country. Usually those time limits are several weeks, months even. So I think that part probably doesn't concern me as much. I think it's about the continuity of treatment, because insurers definitely will embed in the policies a requirement that you are to be under appropriate care, under the care of a physician or appropriate therapist for your mental health conditions in order to continue to qualify for the disability benefit. You can't just receive a benefit and just sort of sit back and wait. They don't want to, you could, but the insurers don't want to see that. They want to see that it's built into their policy and the payment of those benefits, the obligation that a claimant has to try and recover and get better. And there's lots of law around this. I could probably do a whole show on the appropriate treatment issue, but just for the last minute or so that we've got on our show here, I think what I want individuals to understand is that mental health claims are valid claims. They can be scrutinized greater than physical claims, in my experience, and they can be very well supported, both from a treatment perspective and in the eyes of the disability insurer, if that documentation is in place.
And with that, we are out of time and gotta fly. Reach out to Tamar anytime, 1-855-821-5900, help@disabilityrights.ca through email. And that website right there also works, mydisabilityquestions.com. We'll catch you next time on the Disability Law Show.
The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.